interrupt. Tim Long, the Commonwealth Bank. Professor, in the Shergold report, he did actually suggest that there be upper and lower limits to prevent the damage to the achieving long-term targets of heavy spikes, either upwards or downwards, as well as the impact that that would have on the economy. You've ruled that out in your proposal. I'd just be interested, how do you see then the system adjusting or responding to heavy spikes, either upwards or downwards, in both meeting the targets and also in terms of the impact on those industries and the economy?
Well, the price caps and floors don't help you meet the targets. They stop you meeting the targets. Once you hit a price cap, your target doesn't matter. You're issuing new permits potentially without limit to stop the price going harder. So the idea of a price cap is to turn the ETS into a carbon tax at the point where the price cap is reached. From that point, you don't try to meet your target. You just issue more permits. That's the way it works. So there's a choice between having a firm commitment to a target and let the market determine the price and wanting to limit price and therefore limit impact on the domestic economy. And the cost of limiting prices as the target blows out. But you do need flexibility, and in our proposals there are two sources of that. One is lending from the Carbon Authority, so that there will be fluctuations in demand for permits from time to time. We saw in Adelaide a couple of weeks ago a heat wave that was way outside any normal experience. And energy use went up enormously. Well, if that happened on a national scale, then that would be a time when the price of permits was tending to go higher. All of the gas and coal-fired generators would be running at greater intensity and the emissions would be greater. We see that type of situation being handled by lending of permits, and so you get a smoothing over time. And the market would do the smoothing of price over time. There's also capacity for limiting the price movements in our economy through linking with international schemes. I noticed that New Zealand, in its proposals for an ETS, which will come into force at a similar time to ours, they're proposing one-way linking with the European Union, so that as an alternative to buying a domestic permit, any domestic enterprise wanting to emit could buy a permit from the European Union. It's not two-way linking because New Zealand includes agriculture and forestry, and the Europeans don't want to recognise that within their own system. But New Zealand allowing a use of European permits would put a cap on prices at the European level. I think there is a case for that. There are also some qualifications. We've set out some of the issues affecting that choice in the discussion paper, and in the final reports we'll address those questions of choice in international linkages in much greater detail.
My name is Matt Mushalik. I'm from ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. I'm the guy in our group who's doing the number crunching. My latest research on the peaking of crude oil production has now reached even the Pentagon piggybacking on some slideshows of Matthew Simmons. My question is, have you incorporated the global peaking of oil production in your modeling? And have you considered that in October last year, and that is the context for that question, ex-Saudi Aramco Vice President Sadat al-Husseini has actually conceded that we have the problem of 300 gigabarrels of OPEC paper barrels, which means that in the next decade we will have highly disruptive oil supplies. The second question is, have you now started to incorporate James Hansen's new targets? It's not 450 ppm, but 350 ppm. We're actually already 20 years in overshoot mode, and Our task is not only to reduce emissions, but to take CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Two different and separately challenging questions. The second one first. In our modelling, we're focusing on a range of concentrations in the atmosphere going down to 450, but as we said in the interim review, we're aware that many Australians, including conscientious Australians who are very concerned about impact on the natural environment, think that we should look at lower objectives like 400, and in a submission from the Australian Conservation Foundation, the Climate Institute and World Wildlife Fund for Nature, there was a strong suggestion we should model the 400 parts per million case. There are limits to the modelling we can do in the time, so we won't be modelling that case, but we will be assessing it and saying something about it. What we said in the interim report is that 400 parts per million is already gone. If the Australian Conservation Foundation, the Climate Institute and the World Wildlife Fund are right about damage to Australian natural icons like the Great Barrier Reef and Kakadu at 450 parts per million or anything higher than 400, then unfortunately it's going to be very hard to stem that damage. The only possibility would be to, as you indicate, adopt some overshooting scenario where over time move towards a level of emissions that falls below the Earth's natural capacity to sequester greenhouse gases. That would be a very tough ask. So very important issues, very tough ones. One might think they were impossible given the current state of policy discussion all over the world, but we'll have some discussion of the overshooting scenario in our final report. On the first point, there are obviously some very important relationships between scarcity or abundance of fossil fuels emissions reduction objectives. The world's been a bit surprised by the way the scarcity of oil has been reflected in price in the last 4 years. We know the world's been surprised because if you go back only 3 or 4 years, the long-term forward price of oil was about $20 a barrel or in the 20s. And now you get a forward price that's very similar to the spot price of $100. So oil has become much more scarce than the weighted average of market opinion only a few years ago expected it to be, and the difference is immense. What one can see a higher price of oil as doing part of the mitigation task for us. The increase in the price of products based on petroleum is affecting use of many of those products, putting upward pressure on electricity prices everywhere. There is the beginning of adjustment in urban transport in response to higher prices. There's a sense in which the cost of mitigation, the cost of reaching the targets, is lower if the market price of fossil fuels is higher. But when you look more closely at what is the other adjustments that have been going on around the edges of high-priced oil, one can see that it's actually rather a complex matter. There's no reason in economic theory why a high price of oil should necessarily send demand in an emission-saving direction towards use of renewables more or less than it sends demand for energy towards other higher emission sources of energy like coal or conversion of coal and shale and tar sands into liquid petroleum. Empirically, it seems that in the last few years there's been more pressure of the latter kind more pressure from the high price of oil towards use of higher emissions fuels. And for some time, for quite a long time, the higher emissions fossil fuels are not going to be terribly scarce. The world resources of coal are immense. So it's not clear that we are going to get a great help from the price of oil. Over a longer period of time, we may very well do so.
We have a question up the back of the room there.
Tristan Edis, Ernst & Young. My question is, if the Lieberman-Warner bill was signed into law in the US, what kind of target do you believe Australia should adopt for the 2020 period?
I don't want to duck questions. Our review process are very transparent, but we've got a lot of work going on that, and I'll be happy to stand up in public fora later in the year when we've got all of that work under our belt and talk in detail about the targets.
Adam Kirkman from Productivity. Congratulations on the latest instalment. Question that I was discussing with some colleagues this morning is the issue of the CDM and the National Emissions Trading System. There doesn't seem to be a lot of commentary in the work done so far on what role the CDM may play. Is that deliberate, or what are your views on that? Seems to us certainly that an emissions trading system that's going to be chasing a 60% reduction target by 2050 is going to create a lot of scarcity in the market, and when you have what is perhaps considered a default international carbon currency in the terms of CERs, wouldn't we want to be chasing those kinds of low-cost opportunities that may exist internationally?
Well, for those who are not familiar with the jargon, the CDMs are the mechanisms established under the Kyoto Protocol for crediting emissions reductions in projects in mostly in developing countries against commitments to emissions reductions in developed countries. Europe has been the place where the trade in permit generated through the CDM mechanism has been most active. It's a very large trade. European firms have been active in looking for opportunities to reduce emissions in projects in developing countries. We do discuss this project type mechanism, especially in the appendix on international linkages in the discussion paper. Project-based approaches to reduction in developing countries are very much second best or third or fourth best. Much better to have developing countries accept a cap and then to trade in savings beneath that cap. The problem with project-based mechanisms is you find it very difficult in practice to guarantee what is called additionality, that the reduction in emissions is greater than you would get anyway. There's lots of investment going on in energy efficiency in the developing world, and it's a rather difficult task to know that they would not have occurred but for the CDM mechanism, and the mechanism requires a certification that the reductions in emissions are additional to what would have gone on anyway. When they're applied to deforestation, when you've got vast forested areas like, for example, in eastern Indonesia, you may receive credits for conservation in one area that simply leads to accelerated logging of another area. And very difficult to avoid those dilemmas unless you've got an overall national cap. And so I think what we should be working towards is getting developing countries to accept a national cap and then giving a lot of technical assistance and support in establishing the mechanisms that would be necessary to make that work, and then being willing to trade the savings in emissions below their overall national cap. That's the best. Pending that, there is a case for CDM-type mechanisms. How far we would want to push the use of those mechanisms will depend on judgments about what chances we have of getting further with first best approaches.
Yes. Daniel, my question is about the definition of carbon emissions. There seems to be an implicit assumption that there is no lag between production of the good or service and the emissions being in the atmosphere, such that the electricity from this day, the coal used to produce that will be in the atmosphere today. My issue is, it's in circumstances where there is a very substantial lag versus organic waste in the landfills, some of which, when a power of them comes to the is still producing methane now. Is there a basis on which you talk about waste that are part of the standard at the outset, whether that's part of the standard of the service is produced after the start of the standard, with an ability for it to be uncovered previous, therefore able to generate offsets for the gas capture, or I guess price to be cost that way?
Yeah. Well, the question of starting points, cut-off points, only arises if you've got an offsets-type mechanism. If you're simply taxing emissions or requiring a permit from emissions from a certain point of time and giving credit for sequestration of carbon from that point in time, the question of the starting point is not, I think, a crucial one. Or am I missing some point in the question? And we would very much want to have a very wide coverage where, to the greatest extent possible, you're simply requiring a permit from any emission from a certain point in time from the beginning of the scheme, and you're giving a permit for any sequestration that occurs from then.
It's really about your assumption that you can pass costs on, which seems to be based on the fact that there is very little lag between the production of the good or service and the emissions, such that you can actually start from day one to pass the cost on to customers, which is the assumption in the scheme. We've got waste that was buried 40 years ago that is still producing methane, there's very little opportunity to recover that cost from the customer from 40 years ago.
Okay, good point. To be honest, that's a point I hadn't thought about. We'll note that and think about it.
Michael Belstead from the Green Cooling Council. We have a particular interest in industrial gases, in particular the high global warming potential refrigerants and the like. In the interests of what you said, simplicity and credibility, that would indicate that ideally you'd have an upstream approach for, I guess, applying the ETS system to these gases. Considering the high global warming potential of some of these gases, that would then imply a sudden and dramatic increase in the price of these gases to the industry at the outset of the emissions trading system. That would then, in turn, have a very dramatic effect on that particular industry. Has that been modelled? That's the first question. And secondly, would there be any form of compensation for the industry as a consequence of that from the other revenues from the ETS system?
Our modelling is going on now and will be going on over the next few months, so none of the results of that are available now. I've got some very good, very important modelling going on, but the use of the result are in the future. Now, in our scheme, we would like the proceeds of the permits to be applied to forward-looking adjustment to the extent that they're applied to industry. There may be particular claims in equity for compensation for some particularly damaging effects on some participants in the economy. We would see those being evaluated alongside other claims on income distribution grounds, for example, alongside the claims of low-income households for support. But that's the context in which we would see issues like that being examined.
Fernando Chile from Evans & Peck. According to your presentation, it looks like the emissions will be reduced by 60% or long-term. provided that 50% of the emissions come from electricity and perhaps 15% from transportation, does it mean that the government will fund 60% or a policy that will try to target 60% of renewable energy in the medium term or other sources like nuclear power? And how will that cost impact in an economy that is largely reliant on energy?
First, you shouldn't try to read targets from the graphs. We deliberately didn't put any numbers on the axes, so I don't think you can draw conclusions from that. But on your general point, reductions in emissions, once you get the incentives in place, especially the pricing of emissions, are going to come from many sources. There will be an increase in the price of any goods and services that have a high content of emissions and which can't reduce them. So that if the coal, electricity, energy sector is unable to find ways of reducing emissions, then it will, if it's to stay in business, it will have to pass on to households through electricity increases a substantial part of the increase in costs. Now, higher electricity costs or petrol costs or costs of other goods and services embodying emissions will encourage savings of emissions. Probably that needs to be supported by other measures, improved information for households on how to economise on energy use if that's going to have a substantial effect on demand. Within the electricity sector, there's going to be very widespread and complex adjustments. Some emissions reducing measures are likely to be taken very quickly, efficiency measures within individual plants, and once there's a strong incentive to do so, you'll find firms doing that. How big those will be, I don't know, but they will be significant. In the relatively early stages of the scheme, at a relatively modest carbon price, you're quite likely to get injection of gas into the electricity generated process within mainly coal-based firms to reduce the emissions content. There are many technologies being trialled at the moment which will reduce the emissions associated with standard technology coal-based electricity generation. For example, a lot of work on the high emissions brown coal of Victoria on ways of efficiently removing water so you don't waste a lot of coal energy just boiling off the water in brown coal. If they're successful, that will save a lot of energy and a lot of emissions. But the big one for the coal-based sector is carbon sequestration and storage. A lot of good work going on this, including some work associated with retrofitting of established coal-based electricity generators. This work can be accelerated by putting in place the right sort of incentive structures for innovation, for firms innovating in the electricity sector to secure lower emissions. Alongside all of this, there'll be a strong incentive for development of renewables. We're seeing a lot of investment in the renewables industries at the moment, including at the research and development end. There are several listed companies on the Australian Stock Exchange who raised funds to seek to develop new geothermal power in South Australia and in adjacent areas of Victoria and New South Wales. Heavy investments in research, development and commercialisation of clever new technology. One of the motives of that is the prospect of a price on emissions. I think we're all aware of the rather large investments that are going on around Australia in wind and other renewable energy sources. So we're going to move towards well, you mentioned particularly the electricity sector. We're going to move towards meeting low emissions targets with contributions from many different areas, and it's difficult to predict in advance exactly the combination of contributions that will get us to the targets. But we know from all of the work going on at the moment that there's going to be diverse and rich contributions to the mix.
Elaine Pryor from City Investment Research. Professor Garneau, did you look at a variety of different options for compensation for the trade-exposed emissions-intensive industry? And the proposal that you've got for calculating a theoretical commodity price and an annual efficiency improvement factor would seem to reward early action rather than rewarding high baselines, but it seems pretty complicated to actually come up with those factors. Did you look at a variety of different mechanisms for dealing with that challenge?
Yes, we looked at a lot of mechanisms, and we thought in the end that the best basis for compensating making payments to the trade exposed emissions intensive industry, I don't like to call it compensation because it's an integral part of the scheme itself. We thought the best way was the way that went directly making payments to correct the market failures that we were trying to address, and that's what we've come up with. Conceptually, it's very simple. And it would be the Independent Carbon Authority that does the calculations. It would form a view on how much lower the international price, for example, of aluminium is than it would be in a world in which there was universal carbon pricing on a similar basis to Australia. We would envisage is a strong group of quantitative economists and other analysts within the Carbon Authority making their best estimates of that. There will be elements of judgment in the end, but I think less contentious judgment than in the alternative approaches to that that matter that we examined. And we would see the Carbon Authority being required to operate in a completely transparent way. Some ways the model could be the Productivity Commission, on a particular case, putting out drafts of its views, receiving submissions in a public way, reporting publicly on the reasons for its decision. And this will be a continuous decision-making process with revisions every year. They'd be criticised on technical or other grounds if people thought they'd got it wrong. I think in that way we would end up with a robust approach. We would reach a conclusion that the Independent Regulatory Authority would have an arbitral role on those matters, but it would use those powers in a transparent and contestable way.
Professor Garneau, Frank Topham from Caltex. In your report and in your talk today, you talked about auctioning being made on a fixed schedule, weekly, monthly, quarterly, or any other basis. But we know that some policymakers favour infrequent auctions, perhaps annual or maybe twice a year. Could you possibly elaborate on your thinking behind that observation or recommendation? And also, you don't mention whether these permits would be acquitted at the end of the year only, or perhaps more frequently. One would assume it's end of year only. But the first part of my question, I think, is the more interesting from my point of view.
Well, the formulation that you read out does not exclude the annual auctions. That would put a lot of weight on price discovery at a particular point in time, and a lot of market participants might prefer an averaging process. Both the public revenues and the cost imposed by purchase of permits would depend in an annual auction on perceptions of supply and demand and permits prevailing at that point in time. More frequent auctions would allow an averaging over time. I don't think the transactions costs of more frequent auctions would be excessive, given the depth of this market, given the turnover of this market. But if you've got documentation of views, arguments that point in the direction of less frequent auctions, our secretary would be very glad to get hold of them.
Christine Dean, I'm with the European Commission. You mentioned briefly the possibility of a global scheme. Yeah. How would you see that developing?
Oh, I think it will have to develop in a piecemeal way, and it will. We're on a trajectory now of different countries doing things in different ways, or considering European Union as a country for this purpose, and that's the path we're on. I think the emergence of an international scheme and an international price of permits would emerge through the linking of schemes. For example, if the European Union was to accept permits from Australia, and Australia accept the permits from European Union, we would end up with a common carbon price, pluses and minuses of that, as I've already mentioned. But if at some time in the future we both agreed that we were comfortable with the design features of each other's scheme, we could choose to trade freely, in which case we would have one carbon price, and any other countries that either of us linked with would be likely to also have that carbon price. So I see a global scheme as developing piecemeal through this process, and if the linkages became extensive, then probably the need would be seen for some form of international regulation. But I think that will come after the development of lots of international linkages.